We just purchased a home about a month or so before this happened, and our budget was tight. We didn't have too much left over for expensive furniture, so we took to searching the nearby thrift stores and flea markets for stuff we needed for the house. Well, that following month, we got lucky that we lived near the world's longest yard sale. We decided that we were going to spend the weekend scouring for items. On that second afternoon, we started just over the river in Kentucky, eventually making our way to a charming little town of Bell Point. I hit the jackpot at the one stall. It felt like it had called to me. There it was, a long, primitive-style butcher block table, hand-painted a deep brown. With a little paint stripper and oil stain, I figured I could get it back to its original look and make it the focal point of our dining room. As I went to move the table, I spotted the large gold gilt edge mirror laying on the bottom slats of the table. Picking it up, I became transfixed by this mirror. There was an energy about these two items, and I had to have them. The man running the stall sold us the items at a rather low price, almost like he wanted to just get rid of them. He had explained that they were originally found deep in the old, now abandoned Knox Manor up on the hill. He turned, pointing to a Gothic Victorian house that overlooked the valley, peeking through the thick tree canopy and curtain of kudzu vines. I wish he would have told us what had happened to the wife and child of Knox Manor. It was dark by the time we returned home. We left the larger items in the garage, and I went through the rooms looking for a home for the mirror. It didn't feel right, except for in the living room, where I set it on the mantelpiece over the fireplace, across from the foyer that overlooked the backyard. It was an exhausting night, being bombarded with these awful, vivid dreams. I didn't get much sleep that night, from the nightmares to the noises of the house. That morning, I took Percy, my white cockatoo, out of his cage. He first sailed around the room, fluttering by, before landing on the mantelpiece where he inched closer to the mirror, bobbing his head in and around, examining the new mirror. "What do you think, Percy?" I'd asked him. He was such an inquisitive bird. "Lady!" he squawked, stepping closer, his head feathers furled up into a mohawk. "You see me?" I said, pointing at my reflection. "Red lady, red lady!" Percy's voice grew louder. My husband and I looked at each other while he went on repeating, "Red lady." He started to violently rip and tear at the mirror's frame. I tried to pry him away, struggling to calm him. His wings fluttered wildly and nipped at my hands. We didn't know what to do other than to place him in his playpen cage in the enclosed foyer. We'd never seen him have an unexpected outburst like that. He had always been a mild-mannered bird, with a few streaks of playfulness here and there. This behaviour, it was really unusual for him. But we thought maybe he was just getting used to the new house and its contents. It had been rather stressful on all of us, with the lack of sleep, the nightmares and the noises. My husband even started having sleep disturbances as well. All we could do was continue on and hope that we'd transition for the better. So in the meantime, I kept myself busy, spending my days carefully removing the paint from the butcher block table while my husband worked on projects throughout the house. After completely stripping the wood of any paint, I noticed that the majority of the surface was discoloured with these large splotches of dark, almost black rings. The raised stains looked like they had seeped clear through the wood. I wondered if it was water damage. During my work with restoring old oak, I'd seen some pieces with water damage, but it looked nothing like this. And why would it mostly pool in the centre? I don't know if it was the stress of owning a home or just the overall change to everything, but something felt off in the house and it compounded with each passing day. From the reoccurring nightmares to the unsettling noises at night, I felt my sanity slipping. It was like I could sense this dark presence following me throughout the house, and I'd occasionally spot a featureless black figure just at the edges of my periphery. But what terrified me the most were the whispers and the wailing. I'd bolt upright in the dead of night, listening, heart racing. I'd reach over to my husband, praying for some comfort or at the least that he'd heard the noises too. But he never did. I'd be met with a reminder that it was an old home and that we just needed to get used to its noises. I started staying up to the point of exhaustion, hoping to just fall asleep. And maybe it would ward off the impending bad dreams and sleep paralysis. I worked the coming nights well into the morning, sanding and polishing the wood. I was determined to fix the table, but it didn't matter. It still looked the same, and maybe worse than before. My husband recommended that I get some sleep, and we tried to find a dark enough stain to cover the widening rings of black. So I went to bed around 11 that night, exhausted and discouraged. I fell asleep rather quickly. Sometime in the night, I abruptly awoke to what sounded like a crying baby downstairs. Alarmed, and in a delirious semi-sleep state, I reached for my husband, and his side of the bed was empty, his covers folded over as if he had just gotten up. "Anthony?" I was so tired, but the adrenaline was pumping. I crept down the hall, glancing in the empty side rooms. I felt for the hallway light switch, which briefly illuminated my husband down below as he stepped out of sight. Looking over the railing that led to the first floor, I could see him standing at the door leading out into the garage. He stood there rattling the doorknob, spinning it, letting it click in his hand. Was he sleepwalking? I called out to him and was met with no response. I could hear what sounded like a woman speaking in the far living room. On edge was an understatement as I turned the dark corner to see Percy on the mantel, facing the mirror with his wings outstretched in a frightened stance. His head was twisted sideways to face me. Those terrifying sounds, an overlapping argument between a man and a distressed woman, echoed from his open beak. I winced at the shrill horror in his voice, along with the mimicking sound of a crying infant. Percy clawed at the mirror, gripping the edge as I attempted to hoist him away. The mirror slanted forward, shattering on the floor. Percy fluttered out of my grip, landing on a slat of the high ceiling fan, his feathers still standing on end. He kept repeating, "Red lady, red lady." My husband was now out of his trance, confused, not knowing how he had gotten there. It's been over a year now, and things have gotten better since we got rid of that butcher block table, after researching the Knox Manor after that incident. I think I now know why, no matter how much I sanded. I was never going to get the congealed, seeped in bloodstains and evil out of that table.
My best friend Graham and I, we had been best buds for the longest time. Naturally, we became roommates after college. He was like a brother to me. That night was like any normal Saturday night, spent downtown on High Street, bar hopping. But this night was also part of our town's Oktoberfest, so the streets were packed. I remember all night he was in a bad mood, something that happened at work earlier that day. I could tell he was going down the belligerent route that night, so I tried to stay fairly sober. Graham caused a scene at one of the bars, picking a fight with some random guy while I went to take a leak. I had to pull him out of the bar, trying to talk some sense into him. We stopped at the corner mart before strolling our usual way home, down the long cobblestone path by the river. Graham was finishing off one of the beers we had bought, about to chuck the empty bottle at the shoreline, when he stumbled a bit, having been tripped by something in the path. He squatted down, falling over as he picked up a gold pocket watch. "Whoa, where'd that come from?" I'd said, leaning over him. "Don't know, but finders keepers," Graham joked, his eyes lit up, popping open the ornate gold cover, unveiling a secondary layer of a golden-etched cardinal compass. "Dude, this looks expensive." He handed it over for me to inspect it. Pulling back the secondary layer of gold, the intricate open clock face glinted in the streetlight, revealing overlapping layers of fine-toothed gears and levers, dotted with what appeared to be small, precious gems. The delicate gold chain glittered across my hand as I started to turn the knob, hoping to get the watch to tick. I heard a deliberate cascade of metallic mechanisms clicking into place. It almost sounded like an old slot machine. I turned the knob further, watching the dials along the bottom edge of the clock face. The calendar date moved from October 6th, 2023, the three-wheeled dial spinning in different directions, the first dial landing on 2029. The second dial was slowing between June and July. "Must be some kind of travel watch," I mentioned, trying to twist the knob further. It was seemingly locked on a small dial that had a shape of a plane on it. Graham snatched the watch from me, rambling on about how if you overwind it, you could break it. He twisted the crown, and it made that cascading sound of locking gears before it stopped, and he couldn't turn the knob any further. "Great, stuck on October 7th, was all he said as we approached the stoop of our apartment. The next day, I called him from work, waking him. He had clearly slept through his alarm and was surely hungover. He raced to pull himself together to get there for the 10 a.m. company meeting. I knew he wasn't going to make it in time with the morning traffic over the bridge, so I advised him to take the ferry. It had cost a bit, but it would cut his commute by a good 30 minutes. 9:30 passed, 10 a.m. came and went. I excused myself to call Graham, but he didn't answer. Soon we saw the helicopters traveling along the river, near the billowing smoke. I was in shock when I had to identify his remains. Eventually, I had to help pack up his belongings to give to his family. And that's when I found the watch. It had stopped at 9:38, and in the small bottom-left dial, lingered the shape of a boat. I have honestly lived in terror since that fateful day. Those closest to me try to reassure me that it was a fluke accident, and to try to not wear the heavy guilt of that day. But it's more than just that, and I haven't confided in anyone about it. My role in his destined outcome, and the brief glimpse into mine. I've since buried that watch and tried to carry on with my life, but it's like I still feel it. I keep ticking down the days, skimming the skies, waiting for when I'm met with my fateful day in the summer of 2029. I hope I'm wrong, but I just don't know anymore.